Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Paris has been the home of many American expatriates who have emigrated to the City of Lights in search of an environment in which they could reach their potential as artists. Ernest Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, and Henry Miller took up residence in Paris during the first half of the 20th century, but their stories are well known. Less well known is the story of the African-American artists who lived there at about the same time. And that's the subject of our interview today with historian Tyler Stovall. But first, let's take a look at an important event from this week in history. It was during this week in 1848 that James W. Marshall discovered gold at Sutter's Mill in California. Marshall and his milling partner, John Sutter, hoped to keep the discovery secret, but word soon leaked out, creating the greatest gold rush in American history. Over the course of the next year, the 49ers filled the Coloma Valley, overwhelming Marshall's claim to the site. The rush of prospectors proved to be a windfall for Sutter, but it spelled Marshall's financial ruin. By 1850, he was forced off his land, and for the rest of his life, he lived as a vagrant on the streets of various California cities. He died in Kelsey, California in 1885, and a monument was erected in his memory picturing Marshall holding a gold piece in his right hand while pointing with his left hand to the spot on the American River where he made his great, if personally tragic, discovery. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, another symbol of America's past is about to fade from the scene as a result of drastic reductions in the production and marketing of Colt firearms, including the Colt 45, a once-cherished icon made famous in Western movies and novels as the gun that won the West. Since 1836, when founder Samuel Colt first received a government patent for the famous six-shooter, the company has sold over 30 million pistols and rifles. But due to recent government and private lawsuits still pending in the courts, the manufacturer has decided to curtail production. According to a Colt spokesman, if these suits result in the same actions taken against the tobacco industry, they could be worth $1 trillion. So the company will discontinue private sales of many of its guns, but continue to equip the nation's law enforcement and military personnel. New and quite different, if still horrific, images of what was the first televised war, the Vietnam War, are being made available to the viewing public. Once portrayed almost entirely from an American point of view, the Vietnamese are now making their coverage available to the world through a collaborative effort between the Vietnam Cinema Department in Hanoi and the German-based company Progress. The film footage released thus far shows how securely entrenched the Viet Cong guerrillas were in the war, as well as the hardships suffered by Vietnamese civilians from American attempts to dislodge them. You're listening to Talking History.
Je voudrais chérie, ne dites pas ma peine. Je voudrais.
During the first half of the 20th century, Paris became home for many talented African-American painters, writers, and musicians. Why was this the case? What attracted them to the city? That's the subject of this week's interview, in which Talking History's Eileen Dugan talks to Tyler Stovall about his new book, Paris Noir.
Mention Paris, and a flood of images rushes past the mind's eye. Even those who have never visited the City of Light can easily picture the Eiffel Tower, the boutiques of the Champs-Élysées, the dancers of the Moulin Rouge, Ernest Hemingway in a cafe, and hot jazz and clubs open all night long. Invariably, one also comes to think of the African Americans who, for a brief time or for a lifetime, made Paris their home. The dancer Josephine Baker, authors Langston Hughes and James Baldwin, artist Lois Mailou Jones, jazz legends Charlie Parker and Miles Davis, and so many others. What is it about Paris that has drawn so many African Americans to her embrace over the years? With us today to explore the Black experience in Paris is Dr. Tyler Stovall, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Dr. Stovall is the author of the fascinating book, Paris Noir, African Americans in the City of Light. Welcome, Dr. Stovall.
Thank you very much for having me, and welcome to all your audience.
Thank you. You note in the beginning of your book that blacks from America had visited Paris since the days of Sally Hemings traveling with Thomas Jefferson, but it was World War I which proved to be a real watershed in the story of African Americans in Paris. How is that so?
Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, World War I represents the first time in American history that large numbers of blacks from America traveled to Europe, in fact, traveled anywhere outside the United States. Because of the engagement of America in the war in France in the First World War, a number of African Americans went there as soldiers or as laborers for the American Army. Some 200,000 African Americans traveled across the Atlantic to spend about, you know, usually no more than a year in France. Mostly they were used as laborers. Many people in the American Army at that time felt that blacks did not have the dignity to serve as soldiers in the American Armed Forces, and were much more comfortable with the idea of blacks as laborers. But about 20,000 of them, about one-tenth, did serve as soldiers in the Army. And so you had, for the first time, really in American history, African Americans having the experience of getting to see another country, African Americans in large numbers, and not just people that were, you know, often educated or knew something about French culture or European culture, people oftentimes who were not educated at all, people for whom this trip was, you know, the first time I'd been farther than like 10 miles from the place where they were born, for example. And so it really came as a revelation. I think the other thing that's really interesting about World War One is that it comes at a time when race is becoming a real factor of life in both the United States and in France at the same time. World War One represents the year to the high point of the Great Migration of blacks north from the south towards the north, looking for not only better paying jobs, but also better paying conditions. It also represents, in terms of French life, a movement of people from the French Empire to settle in metropolitan France for the first time. And so in both France and the American North, you have this sort of parallel movement of people of color into areas where they had previously been unknown or very, very rarely known, and having a much more important impact upon the life of those societies than they had in the years before that. So for African Americans going to France, you have, you know, tens of thousands of people all of a sudden exposed to the fact that a society that was white, like the United States, could nonetheless treat African Americans in a very different fashion.
And how did the treatment that the African Americans get from the French differ from the way they treated the French colonials?
It differed in a lot of ways. African Americans were very well treated by the French, at least much, much better treated than they were by American whites. One of the things that African Americans experienced was a lot of tension with white army authorities in France, white American army authorities in France, who wanted to prevent them from socializing with the locals. Many French people thought it was very strange that one type of American soldier would treat another type of American soldier so badly, and they often didn't understand that and expressed their surprise. As far as they were concerned, these were people that had come to fight their national enemy, the Germans. They didn't care what color they were, as long as they were good with a rifle. And so they were very welcoming in ways that was often very upsetting to the white American army hierarchy. Now, when you look at the experience of French colonials, you get a somewhat different perspective. The French brought people from Africa, from North Africa, from Indochina, from throughout the French Empire to serve as both soldiers and as laborers for the French war effort. Soldiers, and most of the Africans who came to France, were used as soldiers. Oftentimes did some of the hardest fighting during the war and were very much kept segregated from other French army units. There was also a debate, because most of these soldiers, most members of residents of the French colonies were not citizens of France, but subjects of the French Empire. There was a debate about whether or not it was justified for the French, who prided themselves on having a citizen army, to use colonial subjects. However, the needs of the war effort meant that in spite of the fact they believed in the citizen army, they were still willing to use people as soldiers who could not vote, for example, in French elections or colonial elections. Nonetheless, the French soldiers, or rather the black soldiers who fought for the French army, tended to be fairly well treated, at least according to their own perspectives on it. Now, if you look at the perspectives of people that worked for France, the laborers that came from the French Empire, you get a very different picture. These people were subject to a tremendous amount of discrimination, a lot of hostility to them going out with French women. They were paid lower wages than anybody else. They worked in the worst conditions of anybody who worked in war plants in France during the war, and they were pretty much kicked out wholesale once the war was over because the French said, we're not ready to become a multiracial society. So, especially comparing them with the experience of African Americans, they were much worse treated. And you get a real different impression of that. I think most African Americans were not really aware of this difference. For example, when they thought about the fact that you know, France was recruiting colonial troops from black Africa. They argue that, well, this is W.E.B. Du Bois, for example, that argued this. They would say that, well, you know, look, the French army is willing to use blacks. Why is the American army so hesitant to do so? So this shows that the French are actually more receptive to blacks, not that, you know, this was the way of the French sort of exploiting its own black population. So I think there was a certain amount of naivete there on the part, from the point of view of African Americans with regard to France's treatment of its own colonial population, and simply a lack of knowledge as to what life was like in the French colonies.
And how did African Americans begin to settle in Paris after World War I? Who stayed? Where did they live? What did they do?
Well, for a number of reasons. Many of those who first settled there were people that had been soldiers during the war, and especially people that had been jazz musicians. For a variety of reasons, there was a tremendous vogue in jazz in France in the years right after the war. And so if you could play jazz, you were very popular, and could not only very popular, but could earn, you know, oftentimes a very handsome income. This was happening at the same time as in the United States, there was, due to the end of the war, there was a certain crisis in the music industry. So it was very hard for musicians in places like New York and Chicago to get decent paying gigs. So you had a few people, it was very small numbers at this time, both remembering, you know, what life was like in France and also being told that, you know, if you go over to Paris, you can get a job that is much better paid than anything you can find in New York or Chicago or any other American city. And so people like that. People, jazz musicians generally led the way, but there were others as well. For example, the historian Rayford Logan, who had been a soldier in France during the war, decided to stay in France afterwards just because, you know, he found that the treatment of African Americans was a lot more tolerant there than it was in France itself. In fact, he relates one experience where he was in a French city, I think it was Nantes, and found himself being harassed by a group of young French toughs. This is right after there had been riots between American troops, white American troops, and the French civilian population. And he found that, you know, he was being harassed because they thought he was white. Rayford Logan was very light-skinned. And the way he stopped that was by telling that not only he was black, but asking them to touch his hair and saying, look, my hair is kinky, touch it, and you'll understand that I am black. And they actually did touch his hair, and when they did that, they realized, oh, my God, he is black, and they all of a sudden started apologizing and so on and so forth, and said, we were only beating you up because we thought you were white. So you had people like that who just decided that, well, maybe France does offer a better way of life than the United States. And this happens at a time when, in the United States, it's called the Red Summer of 1919, a tremendous number of race riots, of attacks upon blacks by whites, basically fearing that with the end of the war, blacks will come back, especially blacks will come back from France, believing that they are entitled to a better share of equality than they have been granted before, and wanting to show that black people had to stick in their place. So it was easy to look at what was going on in the United States at that time and suggest that, well, maybe it's better to live somewhere else. And for many people, or at least for a few people, France seemed to be a good place to test that theory.
Now, you have, as almost bookending the story of black Americans in Paris, the story of Josephine Baker. I mean, how does her tale encapsulate so much of the African-American experience in Paris?
Well, Josephine Baker is, you know, she's the person, the one African-American that everybody knows about, who lived in Paris. And her life really expresses many, first of all, sort of the fantasy level of this experience. I mean, she achieved an incredible amount of success at a very early age, coming to Paris in the 1920s. And the way in which she presented herself as this sort of exotic sexual figure really tapped into a lot of what French people were thinking about black culture at the time. There's a tremendous amount of fascination with black culture, often in a rather stereotypical fashion, but that, you know, she was able to use to make her own success in life. Now, I think what's interesting about Josephine Baker, she lives in France for 50 years. She first goes there in 1925 and stayed there for virtually the entire rest of her life until she dies in 1975. During that period, France changes and French views of blacks change. And she is fortunate because she changes along with those times. So, for example, during the Second World War, when many leading lights of the French entertainment world actually collaborated with the Germans, she did not. She joined the resistance, worked for Charles de Gaulle. And so that when the war was over, unlike many of those other entertainers, she was very much respected as a French national icon, no longer just the sensual young woman who wore a banana skirt on stage, but now a part of the French resistance, a part of French patriotic tradition. In the 1940s and 1950s, she gets involved in a kind of political work. For example, she did tours of the United States and demanded that she only play before integrated audiences. and actually helped desegregate certain theaters throughout the country in a way that very much corresponded to a sort of new political emphasis in French life. So she's somebody that manages to keep up with the times, and in fact, I would say keep ahead of the times, and always really symbolizes for the French people what they are attracted to about black culture. And she's and as a result, she's a tremendous success throughout her entire life.
You mentioned stereotyping. How did the French tend to stereotype African Americans?
Okay, well, the stereotype of African Americans, it changes over the 20th century, but the most important one was the same stereotype that they applied to Africans in the early 20th century. That is the idea of the black person as very sort of happy-go-lucky, very primitive, and also very sexual. The whole primitivist imagery of blacks. And so, for example, the French image of jazz music was basically of jungle music, something that came straight from the jungle, something that was very, not very musically sophisticated perhaps, but very expressive and very emotive, and also something very, very easy to dance to. And that, you know, for example, Josephine Baker very much plays into that because, you know, her, the role she plays on the French stage and in French movies are very sensualized, very sexualized, and emphasize the idea that the black person is sort of a child of nature. No sort of civilized inhibitions, no civilized problems or complexes, but rather somebody who simply enjoys life day by day and doesn't think about tomorrow. This reflects, you know, what French, a longstanding sort of French ideas about blacks and other people of color. It also reflects sort of French disenchantment with their own culture in the years after the First World War. And so it's a stereotype that's very easy to pick up on and very easy to apply to African Americans. It is a stereotype, and in many ways it's rather negative. It also suggests that blacks are not intelligent, for example, are not civilized. But the way it was applied, at least in the 1920s and 1930s, was to suggest that, well, this is a good thing. You know, it may be a stereotype, but nonetheless, blacks are good because they do not have these kinds of inhibitions. Now, later on in the century, after the Second World War, a new sort of image or stereotype of African-Americans develops, and that is of the African-American as sort of political victim of racism, somebody who is, you know, very much engaged in the fight against racism, somebody who is basically a walking protest symbol. And that is a very different stereotype, and it's also not quite true. I mean, black people do have lives other than simply protesting against racism, but it is also an image that the French really buy into and apply to African Americans. So there are different stereotypes that the French find useful at different times, but in one way or another, many African Americans find themselves being placed in that kind of box when they are in France.
We only have a moment left, but could you describe the African American community in Paris today?
Sure. It's first of all, let me just say that I think that it's somewhat different from the way it was in the 1920s and 1930s. First of all, the fact is now that you know, France and the United States are much closer together physically. I mean, you can, you know, take the Concorde across from New York to Paris in a few hours, or even a regular flight, and, you know, have breakfast in Paris and dinner in New York the same kind of day. So there's not the kind of difference that there used to be. I think the African Americans that live in Paris tend to be more sort of global citizens, people that are at home in many different parts of the world. They tend to be, I think, very cosmopolitan, very middle class, people that are often very high achievers, because otherwise it would be very hard for them to make a living in Paris. But I think at the same time there are people that, for example, in many cases could, you know, have sort of more money were they to practice the same jobs in the United States, but prefer life in Paris for a variety of reasons. They find it sort of more easygoing. They find it more rich culturally, and they find a relative absence of racism. Finally, I would say that it's a community that's very in touch with other people of color. For example, last year there was a big series of celebrations in France celebrating the 150th anniversary of the abolition of slavery in the French Caribbean. And African Americans are very much involved in those celebrations and using those to reach out to people from the French Caribbean and French Africa. And then finally, I'd say it's a very networked community. It's very easy to meet people in members of that community because they're very conscious of being part of a group that I think is still rather special.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stovall.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. Tyler Stovall, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and author of Paris Noir, African Americans in the City of Light.
S'il existe en ce monde un être plus heureux pour qui chaque soir.
As we just heard, American jazz flourished in Paris in the early decades of the 20th century. Well, so too did another type of music that became popular in America during the 1970s, disco. In fact, disco was born in Paris during World War II for some very interesting reasons. Here to tell us about the origins of disco is Peter Bronstein. Bronstein writes about film music and popular culture for The Village Voice and other publications. He's currently working on books on nightclubs and the 1960s counterculture.
Most Americans associate the word discotheque with the disco music craze of the 1970s, but this unique nightclub format actually dates back to France during World War II. German occupation forces in Paris outlawed American jazz due to its combination black, Jewish, and American cultural pedigree. As a result, jazz music became the chosen favorite of the French resistance, whose members frequented illicit underground clubs where jazz records were played over crude public address systems. The discotheque emerged as the product of wartime austerity and French infatuation with American popular culture. Its literal meaning in French is record library, and it generally refers to any nightclub that features recorded instead of live music. At war's end, the French discotheque concept really took hold with the opening in 1947 of Paul Passini's Whiskey a Go-Go in Paris. The whiskey was a celebration of all things American. Its walls were covered with lids from Haig & Haig and Dewar's whiskey cases, signifying French adoption of American tastes in liquor, while the sound system piped in Le Jazz Hot for French Hepcats. French discotheques guarded their illicit identity forged during the war, and the most famous discotheques of the 1950s prided themselves on a speakeasy-style anonymity. A case in point is Chez Régine, opened in 1957 by the French nightclub luminary Régine Zilberberg. Chez Régine's in-crowd, which included director Louis Malle and writer Françoise Sagan, learned of the club through word of mouth. The discotheque itself was located in the cellar, where a midget dance floor assured the revelers an almost conspiratorial intimacy. The discotheque finally came to America in the early 1960s. This cultural export was facilitated by the inauguration in 1958 of nonstop jet service between New York and Paris on the Boeing 707, which gave rise to a leisure class known as the Jet Set. These glamorous socialites were the discotheque's most loyal patrons, and an international discotheque scene emerged in response to their mobile, transatlantic lifestyle. Another catalyst for the arrival of the discotheque in America was the twist, which became the biggest dance craze of the early 60s and acquainted many American clubgoers with the European high-tech, low-manpower approach to nightclubbing. The first American discotheque was founded in New York City on New Year's Eve 1962 by Olivier Coblin, a French expatriate, called Le Club. It basically transplanted the French disco concept of a low-key exterior, tiny dance floor, and music spun by a disquaire, the French word for disc jockey. As opposed to the high visibility of today's nightclub DJs, the early disc jockeys were meant to be heard, not seen. They spun 45s from a concealed booth while viewing the dancers through pillbox slits. By 1964, discotheques began springing up across the United States. A visit to any discotheque in the 60s might involve the spectacle of people gyrating to dances like the Boogaloo, the Frug, or the Bug, a dance consisting of twitching and scratching one's body as if infested and then passing the bug onto the next person. After a brief heyday in the mid-60s, the American discotheque came alive once again in the 1970s, spawning a much broader entertainment phenomenon that left an indelible mark on American music and popular culture.
You've been listening to Peter Bronstein, a writer on popular culture for The Village Voice. Bronstein's op-ed was based on his article on disco that appeared in the November 1999 issue of American Heritage magazine. This is Talking History. For our site of the week, we continue on the subject of jazz artists in Paris and call to your attention a museum exhibit on that very subject. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The exhibition of the Jazz Age in Paris from 1914 to 1940 places Europe's early jazz movement in historical context. Artifacts and documents gathered from the collections in the United States and Europe help to recall the lives and exploits of musicians and patrons, supporters and detractors, as they made music into history during the earliest years of jazz in Paris. Of course, no exhibition about jazz would be complete without music. Two audio stations and especially produced video deliver vintage jazz performances from the best film and jazz recordings available. The exhibit is at the James A. Michener Art Museum in Doylestown, Pennsylvania until April 2nd of this year, and will move to the Art Museum of Southeast Texas in Beaumont April 22nd, where it will remain until July 2nd.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. On February 4th, the National Cowboy Hall of Fame and Western Heritage Center in Oklahoma City will host The Life and Times of the Buffalo Soldiers, a theatrical production on the history of African-American soldiers stationed on the American frontier. The show depicts the harsh realities of the black cavalry soldier in the West during the 1870s as seen through the eyes of African-American Army Sergeant Brent Woods. For further information, contact the National Cowboy Hall of Fame in Oklahoma City. TBS's American Experience will premiere Nixon's China Game on January 31st, in which recently declassified records reveal unpublicized events that led up to Nixon's 1972 visit to Beijing. And between January 31st and February 3rd, the History Channel will offer a mini-series titled UFOs, Then and Now. Part 1, The Innocent Years, which airs on January 31st, reviews the history of our encounters with the unknown through the 1940s. Completing the story will be Cause for Alarm on February 1st, Nightmare on February 2nd, and Aliens in Contact on February 3rd. Consult your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will take a look at the history of women and dieting. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. I'm